Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone. This is Missy Garcia, your host of MetaMusings, and tonight we have a beautiful guest that is joining us. We are discussing everything between metaphysical, spiritual, and alternative healing here on MetaMusings. Anyone who is joining us live and on the replay, I want to thank you so much. Tonight, my special guest, her name is Joan Parisi Wilcox. Joan is a spiritual teacher and writer. She studied the Andean mystical arts of Peru for more than 20 years and has brought those teachings here to the States. So without further ado, welcome, Joan. Thank you so much for joining me tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And so I kind of want to just jump into what exactly is the Andean mystical tradition, so that we can kind of start there. Can you explain that to everyone?
Sure. Actually, Peru, it has several different traditions. There's very distinct areas of the country. There's the Amazonian tradition, and there's the North Coast tradition, and then the Southern Lake Titicaca tradition. And this mystical tradition that I've studied and that I teach comes from the south central area of Peru in the Andes Mountains around Cusco and the Sacred Valley. So this is a mountain tradition. And it's very heavily an energy practice. It gives you energetic tools to become a conscious human being, to consciously evolve. And the practitioners of the tradition in the mountain area are called Pacos. So I want to kind of point out right off the top that this is not a shamanic tradition. A lot of people call them shamans, but that's technically not correct. They're not altering their consciousness to kind of travel multidimensional realms and, you know, using drumming and dancing or psychotropic substances like they might in the Amazon. This is a tradition that is all about mastering your energy body so that your intent can push the Kausai or push the world of living energy. So it's a path that's really hundreds, if not more than that, maybe 1,000 years old. And it's a Inca and pre-Inca tradition. And as many of your listeners may know, the Incas, the Peruvian in history, they did not have a written language. So this is an oral culture. So this was a tradition that was passed on orally over thousands of years. And, you know, what survives over that length of time usually is something that's very powerful and meaningful and practical that can really change people's lives. And the focus of this tradition is to become the most joyful human being you can be, to be full of well-being, not only for yourself, but for those around you. And it's mystical. I'm not going to run on too long, but it's mystical rather than shamanic in the sense that it's a very personal path. It's a very personal practice in terms of just communing with energy, the energies of nature, and interacting with those energies through your own energetic being. So it's very personal and very practical.
That's beautiful. And I did want to touch on, you said that you studied for more than 20 years, but you actually go and were learning from what you call a Karu, is that correct?
The Karo, they're the most well-known group because of my book and a book by Elizabeth Jenkins and some other teachers. Actually, the U.S. government puts out a series of books called country books, and they're books that have all kinds of statistics and history and ethnography and other things about countries. And in the Peruvian country book that the U.S. government puts out, they actually single out the Karo as the indigenous group, we'll just call them Indians for convenience sake, as the group of Peruvian indigenous people that have actually preserved the Inca and pre-Inca traditions most purely into the current day. Now, that said, I have to say that I've worked with many Karo Pacos, and unfortunately, they've lost a lot of the practices. And I also want to make clear that the when we talk about the Andean mystical tradition, we're not just talking about Caro practices. We're talking about practices that go beyond that particular group to other indigenous groups. So it's very widespread across the mountain area of Peru.
Wow, that's amazing. And I love how you touched on that it's a very personal practice, because I feel that right now that is something that's extremely needed. It's a personal, kind of like an inward look into ourselves to this time. Is that something you agree with?
Yeah, you know, I think most spiritual or energetic practices are by definition personal. But I have to say that what drew me to this tradition was the way in which it's personal, because I had been curious about consciousness and world religions and spiritual traditions, you know, dream studies and psi and all that kind of stuff since I was a young girl. And I studied a lot of different traditions. I learned to meditate when I was 17, and I'm now 60. I, you know, studied certain aspects of Buddhism, Hinduism. I studied in the Native American tradition, and other traditions. And they all have, you know, wonderful things to share with us. But it wasn't until I really immersed myself in the Andean tradition that I found a practice that was not only personal, but that was focused on each of us as human beings in the human world. This is what I think makes this tradition so special. It's not about altering our consciousness. It's not about taking shamanic journeys. It's not about, you know, seeing through the illusion or the veils of this world and leaping beyond this world, or reaching for nirvana or something like that. It's about being right here in the human body, in the human world, but becoming as consciously evolved as a human being as you can. And as you grow and evolve yourself, you know, it's like what we're part of a web. And so as each one of us heals and grows and evolves, it tickles the web, and it helps all of us, as it helps the whole human species grow and heal and evolve, so that we're not looking to kind of leap beyond the human, but we're looking to be really almost like gods in the human body and living in a world right here on earth that is like paradise, that's heaven come down to earth. So a kind of a big cosmo vision that way, but very, very practical. And it's really one of the few traditions I've come across that was so focused on just our humanness and not trying to get beyond it, but trying to evolve what we are as human beings.
Yeah, wow, that's beautifully said. I totally agree with you on that, for sure. And so that's kind of what drew you into discovering that tradition more. How did you actually come across the Andean tradition?
Well, I had read a book that someone had written about his studies in Peru, and I began studying a little bit with him for about a year. But when I actually, it was in the United States, but when I actually got to Peru, I didn't find what I had been taught actually there. It was very syncretized with Native North American traditions and some Buddhist and Hindu practices. So I was a little disappointed in that. And I had come out of academia. I had been working on a doctorate. And so I had kind of that background in research, and I was kind of a stickler for facts and, you know, the quote-unquote, the real deal. So I was disappointed about this disconnect between what I actually found in Peru and what I had been taught in the States, which seemed very westernized and almost a little bit, you know, razzle-dazzle. It was appealing more toward the modern Western philosophical mind. And anyway, so I stopped working with that person, and I really didn't have any connections to Peru, and I didn't, I mean, I wanted to really immerse myself in the tradition, but I didn't know how. So I just, you know, used my intention, put it out to the universe, so to speak, and said, you know, if this is the tradition I'm supposed to be studying, you know, give me the teacher, provide the teacher. And a year later, I met an anthropologist named Juan Nunez El Prado, and a very interesting man. His father and mother are both anthropologists, and his father actually mounted the first modern expedition to the Karo villages. That was back in 1955. So Juan more or less grew up in contact with them. They would, when they came down from the mountains, this was to the Karo, when they would come down to Cusco, they would stay at his house. But he wasn't interested in that at all. There was a lot of political upheaval. This was in the late 60s, and there was, sweeping social change across the globe, really. And Peru was having its own social upheavals. So he was very politically involved. And so he was doing his field research for his master's in anthropology in all these indigenous communities. And whenever he would ask them questions about their political structure, their social structure, their kinship structures, every answer he got from them would go through this whole series of explanations, but ultimately it would always get down to a spiritual answer, something that was based on energy, on interaction with nature. And so this started to intrigue him, and he switched his focus of his research from the political structure of the indigenous communities to their spiritual traditions. And he started to find out that there was this structure of the way these Pacos were trained. He called them priests. So it's kind of like a church, not organized, no dogma and things like that, but we'll just use that as an analogy. So it's kind of like a church where there were priests and our ministers. And he said, well, in order for a church to survive, there has to be theologians. In order for this spiritual practice to have survived in the indigenous communities of Peru that did not have a written language. So it had to be transmitted, over hundreds, if not more than that, years. There has to be some kind of hierarchical structure in the training. So he began looking for it. And what really blew his mind is when he began looking for these Pacos, these practitioners or masters of this tradition, he found them right under his nose in Cusco. I mean, nobody thought that it was a living tradition. They thought it was just stuff that had been recorded by the Spanish conquerors and others over the years, but it wasn't really thriving and living in the Andes. But when he went looking for these Pacos, he found that there were 70 of them right in Cusco. And so there were more indigenous master practitioners than there were Catholic priests and Protestant ministers combined in Cusco in the Sacred Valley. And that blew his mind. It was just amazing. But, the westernized kind of mestizos who were in places of power, who were dominating the culture by then, because remember, Peru was conquered by the Spanish in around 1432. Mm-hmm. So, they had just been marginalized and basically were almost like indentured servants to the great landowners. But the people that were now in power and were making up the majority of the culture of the cities looked down upon the indigenous people. They had no respect for them, and so there was no interest in trying to preserve their traditions. But when Juan looked, he found that the indigenous people had preserved their traditions. And it was a quite thriving tradition, all along the Andes, not just in Peru, but, in the surrounding countries now. And so I met him, and he was just beginning to teach. This was back in 1993, and he was just beginning to teach. So I was very lucky in that I was probably his second or third student, so to speak. And my husband and I both were studying, and actually a couple of other people that I know. But so I worked with him over the years, and it wasn't like I lived with the Karo or I lived in Peru or anything like that. I would just go down every year for between 2 weeks or a month, and occasionally he would come here, and started studying with him, and so it became very immersed in the tradition. And what was especially noteworthy about Juan is that he ended up through coincidence, really, over the course of his long, really, decades of studying with the indigenous Pacos, the master Pacos, he ended up studying with three major teachers who each one taught him a different part of the tradition. We talk about the tradition as the left side, the right side, and the middle. And I can tell you about that in a minute. But he ended up having teachers for each of those aspects of the tradition. And so he's been able to preserve it because all of those masters died in the late 70s or very early 80s. And so he carried it. He's carrying this tradition. This mestizo man is carrying this indigenous tradition. And even to this day, there's no one but him and myself and a few other of his students that are teaching two aspects of the three parts of this tradition. So it was just very fortuitous, and I feel very blessed that I met him and was able to study with him. And I worked very closely with him. In fact, I'm a writer primarily in my career, and I wrote a book with his help back in 1998. It's now called Masters of the Living Energy, The Mystical World of the Caro of Peru. And I was able to bring six of the Pacos down out of the mountains into this little hacienda in Urubamba that I rented for a week, and I interviewed them for like 10 hours a day. And to just get the tradition in their words, because it was starting to be taught in the United States, but there was a lot of baloney that was being taught. Sorry to be so frank, but truly it was just being westernized so much and becoming all this very philosophical. You know, the Pacos are very practical. They don't talk like philosophy professors from Harvard University, but that's the kind of stuff you were hearing. And there were all these practices that were not at all authentic to the Andes. So being the stickler I was for research and for, you know, that whole academic part of myself, I said, well, I want to just talk to the Pacos themselves and get the tradition from them. You know, let them speak in their own words. They speak Quechua. I don't speak Quechua. But I was able to arrange for Juan and another university professor who's a fluent Quechua speaker. And not only that, he's also world famous for his specialty is recording the oral traditions of the indigenous people. Well, he was my primary Quechua translator. And anyway, we spent, you know, almost 5 days, 4.5 days, just talking for 10 hours a day, and I recorded it all. And that's what my book is about. It's the tradition in the words of these Pacos. But that said, these were all Caro Pacos. They had lost a lot of the teachings that are not Caro. There's a lot of very important aspects of the Andean mystical tradition that's, you know, not Caro. On the web and the internet and stuff, it's almost like everyone says everything's Caro, but that's not true. Only one part of it that's been preserved is really comes from the Caro tradition. And most of the young Caros that I've met now don't know that stuff either. So it's a living tradition, and it shifts and changes, but a lot has been lost. I feel very fortunate and humbled and grateful that I was able to preserve the part of it that I did. And so that was a book that I wrote in 1998. It's still in print, and so many people read it. I have a blog, kentiwasi.com. Kentiwasi, it means House of the Hummingbird, and it's also where I write about the tradition and trying to preserve the teachings as I was taught them through Juan and his teachers. And I'm working on a book now with Juan that's his life story. And I mean, we're telling the story of him meeting each of these three master Pacos and everything he learned from them. So when this book comes out, it's going to really preserve all of the tradition as Juan knows it. And he's a world authority on this tradition now.
That's amazing. And somebody was asking, the name of the book that she was just talking about is Masters of the Living Energy, The Mystical World of the Caro of Peru.
Right. It originally came out in 1998 in hardback, and it was called Keepers of the Ancient Knowledge. And then I'd say around 2000 or 2005, I don't even remember now, earlier than that, early 2000s, I had the good fortune of meeting a really exceptional young Paco. He stayed with me here in North Carolina for a while, and I interviewed him and recorded a lot of his teachings. And the book had gone through a couple of different publishers for just reasons of business, and With my new publisher, I was able to bring it out in paperback, and when I did that, I updated the book, and I added about 100 new pages. I corrected a few mistakes. I added a little bit to the about certain controversies in the tradition as Westerners practice it. I added a few comments in the introduction. So the new version in paperback is called Masters of the Living Energy.
Beautiful. And also another book that you wrote, Ayahuasca, the Visionary and Healing Powers of the Divine of the Soul. Is that something that they use a lot in the Andean tradition? Is ayahuasca a part of their tradition?
No, not at all. That's from the Amazonian tradition. In the mountain tradition, ayahuasca, for your listeners who don't know, is a very potent psychotropic plant admixture. It's a tea made of at least two plants, ayahuasca and a DMT-containing plant like chakruna. And it's something that's used for healing and has been used for thousands of years in primarily for healing in the Amazon, in the jungle area. That's a very, very different tradition than the mountain tradition. In the mountain tradition, they don't use anything except intent. And this might be a good time for me to start talking about what some of the cosmovision and the practices of the tradition. That's why I say it's not shamanic. A shaman is someone who can alter his or her consciousness at will. And usually there's certain practices that help you do that. So it might be drumming, it might be ecstatic dancing, it might be fasting, might be chanting, but there's some way that you induce an altered state. One of those ways might be to use psychotropic plant materials. But in the mountain tradition, they don't seek to alter their consciousness. What they want to do is evolve their consciousness. So we want to be full human beings in our normal everyday consciousness, but we want to evolve our consciousness until we are sixth level beings, which is akin to the Christ consciousness or Buddha consciousness. So the kind of long answer to your question is no, we don't use anything to alter consciousness. What we're doing is we're becoming totally and fully responsible for our energy bodies and learning how to be in reciprocity with the living universe, the universe of living energy, so that we can fully evolve. Now, part of fully evolving is that you can develop capacities that may seem like, psi or, magical qualities and stuff, but that's not our goal. Our goal is to be the most fully developed human being we can be. And it all comes down to our personal power. And personal power is a term that has nothing to do with hierarchies or domination. It's not about power over anything or anyone. It's about responsibility for yourself and perfecting your own energy ecology, really being a master of your own energy ecology. So personal power is equated with, it's proportional to your ability to master your energy. But that's the term that they use to accumulate personal power. If you don't mind me just going on here, and I'll just talk a little bit about some of the really amazing things about this tradition, because their cosmovision is just amazing. It's really what drew me into the tradition. Once I touched it, learning the cosmovision, it was just so different from anything else I had seen in any other spiritual tradition. And I have a science background, and I used to lecture on quantum and, just the layman's version of that and biology and alternative health. And so it dovetailed so perfectly with what science tells us. It's not in conflict with it at all. So if you don't, should I just plunge into that?
I was wondering, when you're talking about this tradition, what are some of the things that they do to evolve the consciousness?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear what you said in the last part.
I apologize. I say, what are some of the things that they do in the tradition to help them evolve and step into their own personal power?
Okay. Well, before I can talk about the practices, I kind of have to give you a sense of what their energy cosmology is. And it's very sophisticated, so I'm certainly not going to go into it in depth, but I can give you just an overview of it. And so they would say that we live in a world of living energy, that this is called the Kausai Pacha, which basically means the world of living energy. And they are, the word Pacha is very interesting because the indigenous Andeans understood that there was really no difference between space and time. Their word Pacha means both space and time, but not as separate things. So they had a sense of space-time, like the space-time continuum that, you know, Western science didn't really understand until Einstein in early 1920s. They've had this understanding for years. And so there's this space-time, there's this world, and it's pure energy. It's called Kausai. Kausai is the living energy. And in its most refined form, it's called Sami. That word literally means nectar. So it's the nectar of the universe, like the nectar of the gods. And everything is made of Sami. And this Kausai, this animating energy can form. It comes in all different vibrations and qualities. And it can form in a gazillion different ways, in infinite ways. And all of those ways that it can form is the different kinds of matter that we have. So there's an immaterial universe of just living energy, animating energy. And then it forms into a material universe, which is called the Pachamama, the cosmic mother. And that is all of the material universe, the galaxies, the stars, the earth, okay, the Pachamama. And everything in the material universe is made of this living energy, including human beings. Now, the interesting thing is that, let me go back and say one other thing. Now, there's an organizing principle to the Kausai Pacha. And the organizing and almost evolutionary force of the universe is called Aini. And Aini, it's best translated as reciprocity. So it means that everything in the material universe, in the Pachamama, absorbs Kausai. It's absorbing this living energy, and it's radiating this living energy. So we're in constant interchange with the living universe, including human beings. And everything in the universe, then, is in Aini. It's reciprocity. And in a moral and ethical framework, it's akin to, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or what goes around comes around. So there's we're moving energy, and the universe moves back to us. Okay, it's moving back and forth. But the quality of how we do that is dependent on the quality of our Aini. It's dependent on the quality of our personal power. So you could say it's dependent on the quality of our consciousness. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that's really interesting about this is that it's not unusual for indigenous or spiritual traditions to have discovered that we live in a world of living energy. I mean, just about all of them have. You have, you know, prana, ki, chi, all of these different things. But most traditions, in order to work that energy, to interact with that energy, they develop techniques that usually go through the body, sometimes go through the mind. So, for instance, you can meditate. That would be going through the mind. Or you could do yoga to learn to move and interact with energy. That would be going through the body. Or you could do Sufi ecstatic dancing or things like that. Or the martial arts. Okay, those all started as ways for human beings to interact with the living universe. What's almost unique about the Andes, at least as far as I know, is that instead of developing a practice like that that went through the mind or the body, they went through consciousness. They said the thing that most moves energy in the universe is intent. It's simply intent. And if we can master our intent, then we can be magicians with the universe. We can move the universe. It responds to us. The universe responds proportional to the quality of our intent. And so that's what I mean about conscious evolution. They do have, so they have this reciprocity, this Aini. And they'll say that everything in the material world is made of the Sami, the most refined form of this Kausai, this living energy. Everything, a rock, a cloud, a building, a car, a chair, a dog, a cat, a cow, they're all made of living energy. They're all made of Sami. So are human beings. But human beings have a unique distinction. Because of our psychology, because of our emotions, because of our words and deeds and thoughts, or you could lump that all together and say the quality of our consciousness, which for most of us is not sixth level, it's not Christ consciousness. Because of sometimes the gross or lowly way in which we act, think, perceive, talk, and so forth, we can slow the Kausai down. So when we absorb it, it kind of gets stuck on the skin of our energy bubble, and we don't radiate it perfectly. And so this slowed energy, I mean, Kausai's nature is to move unimpeded in the universe, but human beings can slow it down, or it gets stuck in our energy bodies, or we block it from we absorb it, but we don't radiate it. It gets stuck. Mm-hmm. And so we call this hucha. And this brings up the other thing that I really never found in another spiritual tradition. I'm not saying it's out there. I just never came across it in my studies. Is that in the Andes, they say, okay, even though we have this hucha, we have to understand that it's just slowed energy. It can reduce our well-being because we're not perfect absorbers and radiators of energy, but it can't hurt us. So their conception of energy is that energy is just energy. There's no moral overlay to it. There's no good energy and bad energy. There's no demonic energy and angelic energy. You know, there's no negative and positive energy. Energy is just energy. It's like us saying an electron is just an electron. It's not a good electron or a bad electron or a negative. Well, you're negative, positive, and it's charged. But you know what I mean in terms of it's putting a moral overlay on it. Photon right. is just a photon. They look at energy that same way. So the practice then is to be completely open, able to be in Aini with every form of Kausai in the universe and never be in an energetical jail. There's nothing that can hurt you. There's nothing you need to fear. There's nothing that can contaminate you. Okay, so there's no sense of this good and bad energy. We do, as human beings, because we're social creatures and we live in groups and communities and nations, have to form a moral and ethical framework so that we can get along and live. And so we have these moral and ethical frameworks that we then project out onto the world of living energy. So you have all these traditions where you have very harmful, negative, contaminating energy. The Andeans don't see it that way at all. There's just nothing that can harm you. It's just energy. What can harm you is the quality of your own consciousness because you're not in perfect Aini with the universe. So I'll pause there in case you have any questions. That's kind of the basics of it.
Well, and somebody did say in response to that was there's no shield needed. If there's no, you know what I mean, there's no positive or negative, then you don't technically need like to protect yourself, correct?
We don't, right. We never have to worry about protecting ourselves. You don't have to put yourself in a ball of white light or a gold shield over your belly or your heart or whatever like that. The practice is to become such a master of your energy that you can be in interchange with any kind of energy. Now, what they will say, though, is that because we're not perfect conscious beings and we do have this hucha, that there's actually two dynamics in energy. Energy can be compatible or incompatible. It's not good, bad, harmful. It just doesn't feel good to you. Okay, but the very important thing to understand about that is that it's not objectified. It's only in relation to the state of your own energy. So if I walk into a room, so let's say you and I are in a room and a third person walks in the room. I might have a great Aini flow with this person. It feels great. They're gonna, everything feels compatible. We get along. It feels good. You know, we might end up becoming best friends. Whereas you might interact with this person and it doesn't feel good at all. Okay, it's not that you just don't like their personality, it just energetically doesn't feel good. Well, in the Andes, we wouldn't judge that person. We wouldn't claim to say, oh, they're an energy vampire or they're a young soul or anything that's pejorative as them being undeveloped or that their energy can harm me. What we would do is look at the state of our own energy, because if we were mastering our energy, we would be compatible with everything. So we say, I'm feeling an incompatible energy here. And then you go to work on your own energy body. There's tools, the practices that we have to cleanse your own. And we use cleansing as a metaphor. It doesn't mean anything's dirty or contaminated. It just means you kind of clean up your act. But you work on refining the flow of energy through you. And what you find is that as you continue to refine your own energy body so that energy is flowing, kosai is filling you and flowing through you, that all your relationships end up improving, and you meet less and less energies that are incompatible to you. So it's very egalitarian that way. We don't judge other people. We just take responsibility for ourselves. You know, and if we meet an energy that just feels really heavy to us, then we just say, you know what, I can't deal with that right now. I don't have the personal power. I'm just going to leave it alone. You know, it's kind of like if you have a, Juan uses this metaphor, if there's a big heavy stone in the garden, well, there's nothing bad about that stone. There's nothing harmful or contaminating or, you know, threatening about that stone. It's just too heavy for you to lift on your own. So what do you do? Well, you can go work out in the gym. You can, you know, build your muscles up. That would be akin to just taking care of your own energy so that you're perfecting your Aini. You could go get help from other people. You could use tools, a wheelbarrow, you know, a fulcrum, whatever you need to do to move that stone. But you don't make any judgments about the stone. That's a bad stone. We don't do that when we meet other people and when we feel a flow of incompatible energy. We just say, I've got some work to do.
Oh, wow. I love that. I love that perspective. And
I just want to jump in and say, I'm not saying that another person can't be someone who says hurtful things, you know, does quote unquote bad deeds. You know, I mean, there are people that are, whose consciousness is very gross and they behave that way. And I say gross in terms of like matter or something. It's not very refined. Okay. I'm not saying that there aren't human beings that do bad things. Okay. But what I'm saying is we recognize that, you know, it's up to them to evolve their own consciousness. I'm not going to condemn them. I might not choose to be around them or interact with them. But in terms of an energy flow between us, I'm going to deal with my own, with the flow the way I feel it. Because the way I feel it means is giving me indications about the state of my own energy body. So this is about energetic flows. And again, we have a different context. We have a moral and ethical context as social beings. Okay, so I just want to make that distinction or that clarification.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I can see how that can work. It doesn't matter what they're doing or what they're saying. However, how you are reacting to what they're doing or saying is how you're in control of your energy body, correct?
Right. It's you know, it's really about we can only be responsible for our end of an interaction. And when we're looking at that interaction energetically, that's, you know, even more so. Yeah, that's even truer because we can't really know what's going on in another person, okay? We can just look at the symptoms of what's going on in them. That might be their words, their behavior and stuff. We're going to leave that to the metaphysical God, to that person. I mean, not that we can't be helpful and share what we know and assist another person and support them and, we've got to be real here. But on an energetic level, we won't say, oh, my gosh, like so many people think that person's an energy vampire. You know, well, we're just not going to say that. We're going to say, ooh, that energy feels heavy to me. It feels like it's incompatible to me. I'm going to just work on my own energy body.
I like that a lot. And somebody was asking, what do you feel about, how do you and the Andean tradition feel about crystals?
Well, the interesting thing about the Andean tradition is there's hardly any ceremony or ritual. I mean, the work, because it's energy work, it's invisible. No one will ever know you're doing it. I can be doing amazing things energetically, but you'll never know I'm doing it because I'm just using my intention to drive energy. okay, which can affect the material world. Okay, so we don't use, we don't have a lot of ritual or ceremony, and we don't use any accoutrements. You need nothing but your intent. It's a practice of perfecting your intent. When you're in perfect alignment with the universe, your intent then can, what they call, push the kausai. So that if you're, when you see what, for instance, if let's just say, you know, we'll accept that the record of certain spiritual texts, like, certain Buddhist texts that tell us about what Buddha was able to do, or Christian texts that tell us what Christ was able to do. Well, what were they able to do? They were able to, you know, do miracles, right? Turn, you know, one fish into enough to feed a crowd of thousands. They were, you know, Christ was walk on water, raise the dead. In the Andes, that's just a master who is in perfect aini with the universe. His intent is so pure that he can, you know, be in interchange with the universe and affect the material universe. So we don't want to rely on anything. The Andeans kind of, it's not that they don't use stones, they do, but it's kind of too complex to talk about, but not like crystals and things like that. They might like them. They might use one in healing, but they'll never turn it into a fetish. It's not the stone doing anything. It's not the crystal doing anything. It's not the feather doing anything. It's my intent. So we never want to turn anything into a fetish. And what I mean by a fetish is giving power to that object. In and of itself, that object, it's living energy. It may have its own level of consciousness. But whatever we do with it, it's because of, you know, it's our intent that's driving it. So, for instance, in healing, we wouldn't need to use anything, really. We could just use our intent to help move the energy in another person's energy body. Now, we might do that with this little bundle. It's kind of like a medicine bundle we call the Misha, or in Spanish, the Mesa. But we don't confuse that. It's not the Mesa doing it. It's the love and intent that we're working through the Mesa with. So you need nothing in the Andes. You don't have to spend any money. You don't have to collect things. You know, you don't have to. It's just real. It's just pure consciousness. In its original form, a lot of what you get taught in the U.S. is not going to be like that. And frankly, that's because a lot of Westerners, they don't believe they like all that stuff. They like to have crystals and feathers and ceremony and whatever. And that's okay. We would say in the Andes, you can do anything you want as long as you know why you're doing it and what's happening. And so you could do the most elaborate ceremony you want. Have fun. The Andean practice, there was a word pulie, which means play. It's sacred play. So you can do the most elaborate ceremony you want. You can use the most elaborate crystal you want. But you're only choosing to use it because it looks pretty and you like it, not because it has any power of its own. It only has the power that you're sending through it.
Yeah, the power of intent. Absolutely. That's beautiful. So someone was asking specifically, when you talked about how you or the Indian tradition cleanses, not necessarily because of anything dirty, but you talked about cleansing. Can you talk about how, what that is and how they cleanse themselves?
Sure. There's two primary practices. And the Quechua, as I said, the language is Quechua. And the Quechua words, Saman Chakwi and Saiwa Chakwi. And the primary one is called Saman Chakwi. And the first part of that word is S-A-M-I, which is Sami, which means that refined kausai. The second part of that word is chakwi, which means to take action or to do something. So this is a practice, literally, that means taking action with sami or taking action with kausai, the refined energy. And it's so deceptively simple. But the old masters say, if you did nothing else but this technique 10 minutes a day, that you can reach the sixth level of consciousness. You can become so refined. Your Aini can become so perfect that you become Christ-like or Buddha-like. And it's very, very simple. And I haven't told you anything about your energy anatomy, so it might not make a lot of sense, but we have an energy body. it's like a, just for, it's not an egg, but we'll just say it's like an egg of energy around us. It's beyond our body, and it also interpenetrates our body. And it has a structure to it, just like our physical body has a structure to it. It has what we would call mystical eyes, 12 mystical eyes, 7 primary ones and 5 secondary ones. It has these certain cones that go from these eyes to the back of the head, to the back of the spine, or to the front of the pubic bone. Okay, so we have, it has an anatomy to it. But in this technique, basically, what we want to do is we want to move energy. We want to always be absorbing it perfectly and radiating it perfectly. When we're not doing that, we slow energy down. So what we call that hucha. So Saman Chakwe is about getting that slowed energy, that hucha, moving again. So we just for convenience sake, we call it cleansing hucha. Okay. So it's, and the metaphor that they use in the Andes is kind of like you're taking a shower. Just like you have to shower to clean your skin and your physical body. If you didn't, your skin would get all grimy. You'd probably get a skin, you know, rashes and infections and things like that. Well, in a similar way, this hucha, when we slow energy down, the slow energy tends to collect on the outside of our bubble, what we call the skin of our bubble. It doesn't get very deep. It can, but it takes a long time. So most of what we do is collect this hucha. We slow this energy down as you know, we're starting to absorb it and we don't radiate it. So it gets this, we get a lot of slow energy, you might call it, hucha, around the skin of our bubble. So what we want to do is get it moving again. Well, how do we do that? Well, in the Andes, you use your intent. The primary understanding of the Andes is the law, really, is that energy must follow intent. Okay, so if you intend something, it's influencing. We can't control the universe of living energy, but we can influence it. So our intent influences it. So basically what you do is just intend to kind of open the top of your bubble. There's a point at the top of the head and at the top of the bubble. It's one of those mystical eyes. You just kind of open it. I visualize it like a cone, but you can visualize it any way you want. It's really like the diaphragm of a camera opening to let more light in, say. And you command, you intend to pull Sami, this refined energy, down into your bubble. And as it flows into your bubble, you intend for the hucha, the stuck energy, to just move. And the way we move it is we feed it down to Mother Earth. So you would imagine a root or a branch or a cord or something coming down from the base of your spine and just going deep into the Mother Earth. And you draw the Sami, the light living energy, the refined living energy, into your bubble, and you release the hucha down through this cord down into Mother Earth. She's the great composter of heavy energy. You know, as I said, heavy energy is not contaminating or dirty or bad. It's like food. You know, you could think of the Sami coming in as food, and for whatever reason, this is not a perfect analogy, but that which we don't use, you know, our body digests all of the stuff, you know, most of the food. It gets its nutrients from that. It keeps us healthy, but it can't use some of it, so it eliminates it. Well, in a sense, this is a rough analogy, when Sami wants to flow through us and that which doesn't, it's just like that part of the food that we can't digest. We send it down to Mother Earth. She composts it. It's like a compost heap. There's nothing bad or contaminating about a compost heap. You keep turning that compost heap over, Mother Earth's going to turn those scraps of food into rich, fertile soil. Okay. So she takes our hucha, she gets it moving again, and it becomes Sami again. And it's that simple. You just do that for 10 minutes, and then you stop the flow from from the cosmos into your head or the top of your bubble, and then you pull the cord up and you stop it. It's that simple. But I'll tell you, it can take a lifetime to master, to really get your energy going. But it is happening at some level because energy must follow intent. There's kind of a lot more to the tradition than that, but it's really, that's the core practice of the tradition.
Amazing. So I know we are getting close to the end of the show. We have about 11 minutes, but before we go, I just wanted to recap for everyone. If you would like to look at Joan Ferguson Wilcox's web and website. She talks about the Indian tradition of rites on there. It is kentiwasi.com. It's kentiwasi.com. And she has a number of books out, but the one that she was talking about earlier, which has to do with the masses of a living energy, the mystical world of the Tarot of Peru. So those are the books that she was talking about, but she has many more, so feel free to check that out. And I know that in the advertisement, we have talked about the Andean tradition talks about this time that we're in right now as the new humanity. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, that's what, you know, everything about the tradition is about the conscious evolution of human beings, about being the absolute most perfected human being you can be in the most perfected human world. Mm-hmm. And they have several prophecies that have to do with the rise of the new humanity. And we happen to be living in a period of one of those prophecies, or actually several of those prophecies. They have some, in the prophecy, it's called the Tari Paipacha, which basically can be translated several ways, but the way that resonates for me is the age of meeting ourselves again. So it's like a big spiral. It's an evolutionary spiral through history. And they say that there was something called a Pachacuti, which means basically like a cosmic transmutation or overturning of space-time that happened around 1993. These happen periodically, and one started around 1993. Now, these, of course, it's not, you know, pinpointed on a year. It's you know, time before and after, but just generally around 1993, where you might say the curtain started parting for an energetic transformation, the potential for a conscious and energetic transformation of humanity. And this, there was a period from 93 to 2000 where this curtain was opening. And then from 2000 to 2012, and yes, the Andeans have the same date as the Mayans and certain other traditions about this year 2012, it was like the, you know, curtain parted and we revealed a door and the door began opening. And in that, so we're well past the door opening and into a period where it's just an auspicious time of potentiality for humanity, where we can begin to really start cleansing our hucha collectively, individually and collectively, and doing that kind of saman chakwi on a global scale, so that we can transform as a species as well as just a global community, but actually as evolving our species. And they and I haven't been able to talk about the seven levels of consciousness, but they also so this is a period when we talk about evolution, we're talking about conscious evolution, not only of us as individuals, but of our species. And I'll just try to quickly tell you, they also say that we have three human powers. There's three primary human powers. We want to be in harmony with all these three powers, and most of us aren't. And one power is yunkai, which is the body, the ability to do work, make an effort, you know, to survive as a physical being in the world. Another one is yachai. Yachai is reason, intellect, logic, which the Western world is master at. And the third is munai. Munai is love, but it's not like a Hallmark love. It's not a sentimental love. It's love under your will, okay? And the prophecies say that over the course of history, most of this is the way I'm interpreting it for you, because just to make it quick, that the early peoples, and they have a name for them, they say that there was the age of the wild men, the age of the solar men, and now we're in the age of the metaphysical men. But during the early period, we were mostly, as a species, we were mostly yunkai. We were mostly in our bodies. It was, you know, the hunter-gatherer trying to survive. And then there arose civilizations that were highly evolved with their yachai, with their intellect. So this is the you know, enlightenment and the age of reason. And we became, you know, back to the Greeks even, we became philosophers and scientists and poets and so forth. And this is the stage we're still really trapped in most of the Western world. most of the indigenous world is still very Yankai. A lot of them are still at the level of just subsistence, you know, human subsistence level with shelter and food. And the Western world, the developed world, is very overdeveloped in Yachai. So we rely very heavily on our brains, on our mind, on our intellect. And the Andeans say that their gift to the world is Munai. Munai would be our feelings, but the higher feelings. It's interesting that in the Andes, the emotions are in the belly. Those emotions like worry and jealousy and competitiveness and all of those kind of stuff, it's in the belly. But our the feelings, as opposed to the emotions, they're different things. The emotions are in the heart, and those emotions are the higher level human expressions, such as compassion and empathy and love and kindness and generosity. And so we need to be in balance in all three of those aspects of ourselves, and we're not. And part of the prophecy is that we're in a period where the metaphysical God, the divine intelligence, whatever it is, who gave these gifts to the different peoples of the world, is going to draw the his children or her children together. And they'll sit down at the table of the world together and share their gifts. So we will, those that are developed in Yankai will teach us Yankai. Those developed in Munai will teach us Munai. And those developed in Yachai will teach others Yachai. And we'll become harmonized as a species and live through all three of the human powers. And that this then precipitates the evolution of our species into a new humanity. And each one of us can contribute to that. And this is the interesting thing about the Andes. They don't just have these prophecies. In most cultures, when they have prophecies, they're very passive. They're just stories. In the Andes, they're living prophecies. Every Paco who knows the prophecies is working them. We work them by developing, refining our own, developing our consciousness, refining our own energy body, so that each Paco is doing the work on him or herself so that they can contribute to this evolution of our species. And so can each one of us. As we work our energy, as we refine our intent, as we evolve our consciousness, it's not just for our, you know, the good of ourselves, the relationships we have close around us, our communities, it actually shifts the whole tenor of our nation. And it and then as each nation develops, it shifts the whole tenor of our world. And the ultimate goal of all this is to actually have, for us to be six-level beings, to each be Christ-like and Buddha-like, and to live in a heaven on earth.
That's beautiful. Beautifully, beautifully said. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, wow. Actually, I don't even have words after that. That was awesome. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a tradition that really matters. I mean, it matters not only on a personal level, but at the level of your family, your community, your city, your nation, and ultimately, you know, on the world, for the world. And it's an active practice. It's not just, you know, a kind of Hallmark sentiment. It's really our active practice.
Yeah,
but we do it by paying attention to what, you know, we say in the Andes, each person's the center of the universe, because we can only know our own energy. We can only work our own energy. But if we're all the center of the universe, then we're all affecting each other as well. You know, we're there together.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's amazing because it's such a put words to things that I intuitively know. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. I didn't know how to express them. So hearing some of the views of the Indian mysticism tradition and things like that is really something that is hitting something in my heart right now. So,
you know, if I could just end by saying, it's such a simple practice. It's such a simple tradition. I teach the tradition over a weekend, over 3 weekends. That's it. It doesn't take a gazillion dollars. It doesn't take years and years and years of study. The techniques are simple to learn. I mean, they might take a long time to master, but it's it's so it's just certain practical tools that can make all the difference to your life. So you can learn it quickly, and then it's up to you to practice it over time.
And can we look to sign up to learn from you on your website at kentuwatson.com?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, or do you offer classes through your website at kentuwatson.com?
Yes, I'm going to be starting two new series of trainings, one in California and one in New York, upstate New York, in 2017. And I'm certainly open to, if someone has a group that wants to host a training, and they can go to Kenti Wasi, and under the tab that says Learn the Andean Sacred Arts, then they can see the upcoming trainings there, and they can read about the three different trainings and the focus of the three different trainings. And they can contact me at kentiwasi@gmail.com.
Thank you so much, Joan. We're at the end of the show, and I just am so grateful that you joined me. Have a wonderful, wonderful night.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to all your listeners for their time and attention.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.